I have a question, I'm not sure if you have any remarks you'd like to do. Just with regard to defences for countries, it seems to me that a possibility could be contracts, defence contracts with bigger countries, alliances as well, there might be some implicit contracts, explicit contracts where a certain amount of money. A contract was made with a much bigger, stronger party come to their defence, have a presence to, and to do that work. It could be a win-win situation. The bigger country gets some money, and the smaller country gets hopefully a workable defence money. Do you have any questions on that?
And of course, historically, these attacks are quite common in Buddhism. The actions sometimes in some individual are exported, and which is true, but not to the building politics aspects when contracts when Palermo citizens have been in contract these days. And actually, what I heard yesterday, the Kurds actually were negotiating more, deciding whom to invite what they were. Actually, these are not explicit private contracts as such, but very similar ones. And actually today, Iceland is almost in the situation right now, because it actually has no real force, military forces in our normal understanding, and actually the US is kind of very protective of Iceland. So I think that it's of course this normal practice and it's a viable solution. But in practice, I would say that these contracts have quite a different economic ends in the case, because sometimes it is your normal contract, and you just invite a company or even the state acting as a company, which they in such a case, as a protector. And in some cases, it does not decide which bully are you going to pay in order to be protected against the public and being like needed for this bully because they are attacks or just money for protection. But I think that that's one question.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Actually, that's a really bad idea. The whole idea of collective security only spreads wars. If you contract, say, with the U.S. by joining NATO, as the Baltic nations have, what you do is that you ensure that we're going to have Cold War II. Look, the biggest bully on Earth is the U.S. government. I mean, no other government going around, invading countries, and actually setting up a principle of preemption. It's just unprecedented arrogance. So that when you're talking about bullies, you really have to start with the capital, the world capital of bullyism is Washington, D.C. And, so I was kind of astonished to see Putin up there and not George W. Bush. One is the teacher and one is the student.
Maybe you want to look into your US South, actually, Russian Federation, because I think it's very American-centric, and I fully understand it when you live in America, that your own power is the biggest bully. But it's like not noticing what actually Russian Federation is doing.
I don't see the Russian Federation invading any Baltic country. I see no prospect of doing that, but by Estonia joining NATO, that is a provocation. NATO should be abolished. And, the UN, the U.S. should pull out of NATO. Of course, NATO was founded to ostensibly defend against so-called Soviet expansionism. But in fact, didn't the Soviet Union dissolve? There is no more communism, so there's no more reason for NATO to exist, if there ever was a reason, which I very much doubt. If we were talking about the free rider, well, what you're writing on is my pocket. thanks for no thanks.
Well, the question I was going to ask you concerns what seems to be a minor discrepancy between the way Justin and Robert reported what's going on in Europe and the United States, and Justin depicted the American media as being almost uniformly hostile to Ron Paul, which is exactly what I remember. In fact, I know this book was commented on as a lot of writers, how hostile the American media was. You, in the rock gave the impression that this was somehow more characteristically European, but I don't think it was very much, unless I'm wrong, it was probably not much difference. Would you agree, or do you think European precedence is even more contentious and neglectful in terms of reporting around Paul's conversation?
Well, basically, the European press did their best to ignore him, and they had an easier job ignoring him because the Americans media were more or less ignoring him or disparaging him. So for them, it was which one is the most likely, or which ones are the most likely of the Republicans and Democrats? We're going to report about them. And the big differences between their issues, which this one called sort of strange, she's got weird views, we don't understand that. So there's an extra effort involved in understanding what it's actually talking about. And if you've got a strict timeline and everyone else in the country you're reporting about is talking about all the others, there's not much of an incentive to start and talk about this weird guy. He was largely ignored. So there may have been a half sentence on a normal leading article of 500 words or so, there, half a sentence. So yes, one poor, a bit strange. That was it. You're right.
Well, I think just a short comment, a question also. The comment is that I can see that all the Americans in Washington is significant. But I would like to kind of point out the suggestion that it was not the United States who murdered 1/3 of the Iranians or 1/5 of Poles. It was Soviet Union. And president of Russian Federation today is saying that Soviet Union was the greatest country in the world. And everything which it did is very good. So that's why I kind of completely back immediately since this in his picturing the president of Russian Federation, KGB, Kirill. Who is all covered with blood and skin and all this kind of thing? Besides that, I'm really going to leave the government by the Republicans, in which he's saying that all the small countries of Europe should have a system of collective defense against the big bullies. He holds the bullies are Russia, Germany, and Italy, for some reason, but was in 1944. But what do you think if, for example, instead of NATO, we would have small countries with a collective expulsory mechanism? For example, Baltic states and Eastern Europe. Well, this is like about 23 Eastern European countries who have a system, we call it Eastern European Democratic Union.
I mean, I'm getting awfully tired of hearing about how Putin is, the new Stalin. I mean, Russia is demographically shrinking. Okay, the Soviet Union is over, and Russia is lucky if it survives into the 22nd century as a unitary state. And if you look at what is happening, the West is encircling Russia deliberately as a strategy. Okay, they have NATO is at the gates of Moscow, number one. Georgia is about to enter NATO. Kyrgyzstan is about to enter NATO. We have bases all around, and every day we have George W. Bush or some neocon in the State Department or elsewhere saying, yes, Russia is backsliding. Well, Russia is not only backsliding, given that they're coming out of how many years of the most oppressive authoritarian government ever. And you know what? I don't think that Putin personally killed all of the Lithuanians. This is just emotional demagoguery and warmongering. And if we have a second Cold War, it'll be because well-meaning people are mouthing this rhetoric. And that's all you're doing. The neocons hate Russia. And that is their next goal. They want the oil in Central Asia. They want more bases. And that's their agenda. And if you want to sign on to it, then you're welcome to it, Yuri, but I won't.
And I'm very, very surprised because, we are on the side of liberty. Why do you think Georgians or Ukrainians or Ukrainians wanted to join NATO? And because they love George W. Bush? No, because they're very much afraid of that evil coming from Kremlin. That's what it is, yes. Besides that, I talked to a couple of days ago, I talked to a friend of mine who's a guy in Moscow. And I talked to him about attributes, Putin effort. He said, okay, I'm the guy in Moscow, I hate Putin. So should I embrace George W. Bush then? Or if you hate George W. Bush, and I don't like him as well, so should I support Chavez or Castro? Or,
you know, no one's saying you should support him or Chavez.
But that's what you do.
No, I do not. And I don't recall doing that. What I am saying is that we ought not to declare Cold War II before anybody does anything. And well, I mean, who is provoking who? Let's look at the empirical facts.
You're completely denigrating Georgians, Ukrainians, Ukrainians, and Ukrainian
members. You
should decide that in Washington, D.C. You should be.
I'm just saying that I don't want to subsidize their defense. And I don't want, I want the U.S. out of NATO. I mean, look, if you want to defend yourselves, fine. If Georgia feels it must have Abkhazia, even though Abkhazia does not want to be part of Georgia. And it must have South Ossetia, even though the South Ossetians don't want to be part of Georgia. I mean, what about secessionism? If Kosovo can be independent, why not South Ossetia? You know,
another question, please.
Boy. Robert, in America, on the heels of Ron Paul's message, Ron Paul, the man's his message, we have about half a dozen candidates who call themselves Ron Paul Republicans. Do you anywhere in the European scene see Ron Paul candidates emerging?
Well, it won't work, no. at least not yet. The difficulty, of course, with Europe is that in America, you have this centralized system with that one person who is aiming at the center. So he is a point to which everyone is looking. And we have now the European Union, but it doesn't have this presidency. We don't have it yet. But and even if we did, we're all 27 different countries with I don't know how many different languages, which makes it much more difficult for some such phenomenon to emerge. And because we are Europe is looking at the American situation, we're just those that are convinced by Ron Paul, we still are looking for possibilities to express this, but I can't see at the moment that it could be anything candidates, at least like in Germany, not because it's such we don't even there we have a president, but he's not elected directly, so he has to go through the system first, very much more than in America. And the same applies to Britain, similarly, certainly in France they had a direct elector, but I can't see that emerging in the near future. There will be different forms of government. I'm sorry I'm speaking so vaguely, but I can't see that's the kind of development yet.
So I think we must talk about the situation because you are not very, very well informed about the problems in Germany. I think that there are several things coming from KGB, what happened in Germany. I mean, I'm not very happy with that. Of course, our institution is not a political institution. We are the impact which works on economic things in the South of the Ocean for economics. And I don't think that this, what you said, are really real life of the people around the Russian Federation. Maybe you have wrong information.
you have a question, or is that just...
No, he wants to announce that he wants to talk to you.
Oh, okay. Probably. In other words, meet me outside, okay.
Any other questions?
I just, regarding the long border Europe, it occurred to me when that discussion going on that it's almost a franchise, it's almost a brand. And it can, regardless of language, it can almost be promoted as a, because I'm wrong, normal, it's a brand. So, can you comment on that?
It certainly has all the characteristics of a brand. I envision franchise-like structures where people work independently, and decentralized, and find their own ways of expression, which may, especially in Europe, be mainly outside the official political sphere, but having a great effect on the political sphere by using the websites and blogs to organize events that have great publicity value. And in this way, promoting the brand, yes.
Well, I got a non-European question. Yeah,
okay.
Just being a US active, US voter myself, we wouldn't be able to vote for him, Paul. Right? But should we then vote for Mr. Barr? What can you say about him?
Barr,
did you recognize him, Henry?
Well, I haven't followed him very much. I've only stood there about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but other than that, I don't know very much about that. I'd rather ask that question to Justin.
Well, I mean, why endorse Barr? I mean, you're not going to be Barr, are you? Barr is a continuation of the Ron Paul revolution. But again, I mean, Ron Paul really rose because he's such an unlikely icon. I mean, he's modest, it's not all about him. And it's just about ideas. I mean, Bob Barr is much more of a politician type, and he has a long record. I mean, he was the leader of the impeached Clinton campaign in the House of Representatives, and then you call the Americans in the audience. And he is not Ron Paul. So, you know, I mean, it's not the brand. I mean, it's not the same brand. And I can't see young people going crazy for Bob Barr. It's really too bad that Ron did not run as a third-party candidate. But he's getting on in years, and, he would want to rest. Bob Barr is great. And if he gets nominated, didn't he have a convention? Right, yeah, it's going on right now. Who knows what the wackos and the Democratic Party are going to do, given their record. Somebody else may get the nomination, I would support Bob Barr as a private individual. If anyone gets it, so yeah, go Bob, go.
Question to Rodriguez. Continuation of our question of should we be in NATO and who should be in NATO and should there be an alliance? What is your take on the issue? Do you think is it viable to have defensive legal small nations? And would they act as a footprint if they are all, gather up and try to be like medium sized country or bigger sized country?
Of course, I agree that entering NATO means entering some club of collective defense and actually collective defense cities. Actually, what is in the base of global city base for entering NATO is like constant pressure to increase defense budgets up to 2% GDP, which is still lower, but pressure to increase it, and with increasing taxation. Then we have, of course, are like mildly pushed participate in non-NATO but collective kind of defense actions in Iraq or Bosnia or in Afghanistan, and the same soldiers do, and of course I'm against that. But on the other hand, you know, there are some circumstances, and you know, it's very understandable that citizens of small country, let's say Lithuania or Estonia, they do not care so much about how strict the American borders are. If they want to invest money or spend money on some kind of NATO or collective security, okay, why not spend on our security? Of course, it's free riding on your taxpayers' money. But you know, if you are willing to pay this money, I do not have to care for this. So it's kind of your problem. And again, maybe I'll already go into a little bit more about this. I completely do not understand what you mean by provocation, because no, there are some people and some heads of states which are constantly being provoked, even though the similar actions concerning other people or other heads of states are not being as provocation. And speaking about like this pacifistic. Nice stories about singing revolutions, which I participated as well, or other kind of revolutions. I very much admire those, but actually I see that from my presentation that in order to have this kind of revolution successful, you have to have at least some kind of consent with an aggressor. Because in this case, for example, in this story about from the movie, let's say, about Estonia, part of the story is that Jakarta Dyer, who was after became a president of Chechnya, was chief of one of the biggest garrisons in Estonia, and actually he ordered his soldiers to stay inside, not to attack, of course, singing peaceful people. And in some other cases, again, it was like consent. And the same was like in British and Indian population movement, the same was in Nazi Germany, attitude towards Danes or Norwegians or citizens of the Netherlands, because they treated it somehow as higher than those citizens of Poland or Belarus. And it meant that so Danish people were able to be conquered successfully in peaceful, non-violent resistance. But it depends very much on the attitude of them. And so the best is very nice, but it doesn't work, of course. And one last remark is that we have to be very cautious in speaking about collective security or national security, because all these concepts, collective security, national security, centralized security, planned security, tax finance security, all are quite different concepts. And a kind of collective security when I agree with my neighbor to protect each other, or we agree to pay defense agents, it's also a kind of collective security. That's nothing wrong with it. We have to look at other aspects of this. So collective security as such doesn't mean centralized security or taxpayers' money and finance security. So these are completely different things.
If I could just answer that. If you want to know what the provocation is, it's called a missile defense shield, which means that now in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and throughout Eastern Europe, there is a system in place which would enable the West to conduct a nuclear first strike on Russia. So they consider that, they consider that a provocation, and they feel endangered, especially in the context of the warmongering rhetoric and anti-Russian rhetoric coming out of the White House and many neoconservative media outlets. And as far as this quality of collective security, I would refer you to Mark Rothbard on the evils of collective security. And his argument, very briefly, was that this spreads conflict, but it has these all these alliances that what started out as brush fire will turn into a conflagration and a world war. In fact, that's how World War I started. And no one was advocating, and finally, I just want to say that I know you don't care whether you're oppressing US taxpayers, but I know that internationalism is non-reciprocal. So you want us to protect you, but you don't care if we're oppressed by our state. I mean, that is it doesn't seem right.
Peter? Paul, whatever, Paul.
Peter, Paul.
Thanks. I actually wanted to come back to Remedius's remarks a little bit, and also some things that there's going to be a Yuri and Justin show here. It seems to me that there was actually an attempt between the wars, at least a couple of attempts, at collective security among the small states. There was the Little Entente, there was the Balkan Pact, and there was one, at least one other similar kind of agreement. And of course, they failed ultimately to protect the national independence of those states. And I think the reason that they failed, the reason that these kinds of arrangements have that failed in the past, is something that Remigius hit upon at the very end of his remarks. Unfortunately, he only touched on this briefly, but I think this is really the key, and that is free trade and investment. That the thing that was lacking in the interwar period, the reason why, in my opinion, anyway, the reason why these attempts at public security among the small states ultimately failed, because they weren't matched. Military agreements and military cooperation, such as it was between the different successor states of the Habsburg and Ottoman empires, wasn't matched by similar economic integration between those states. And one of the things that you posited that I thought could be a very fruitful line of inquiry is whether or not ultimately the only real defense of a small country against a larger neighbor or imperial-minded threat is to encourage investment by it, to make it in the material best interests of that country not to attack a small country like Estonia or Lithuania or what have you. Now, my question though is that this sounds to me, I mean, I'm very attracted to this proposition. But I'm wondering if the flip side of this is that, historically anyway, nationalists have always regarded foreign investment not as some kind of benign way of fostering cooperation. They've regarded foreign investment as bullying. Now, what I'm wondering, I guess my question to you is, given this both empirically and theoretically, what do you think in the case of Baltic states, which I imagine you're most familiar, but you can expect this out of other areas that you may have experienced. But I'm just curious, to what degree do you think the climate for this really exists currently in the Lithuanian sphere? Saying that Russia should be interested in investing money in Lithuania, do you think that most Lithuanians, in general, perception of that investment would be as yet another kind of Russian bullying, or do you think that it would be welcomed as a way of fostering some sort of peaceful relations with Russia?
Yes. Thank you. I also think that this is one of the main points I want to stress, but I would say that this is not acceptable to the majority of the population to think that, unfortunately. And as you just did, some examples of here have one example. We have a huge oil refinery factory, which is connected with the Druzhba or French pipeline with Russia, which supplies oil. And this refinery was twice sold to foreign investors. And because, first of all, it was sold to an American company with huge pressure from US embassy and so on. And it was like a slogan that, you know, we'll not let Iran to the pipe. We will not let Iran to the pipe. Iran means like a symbol of Russian investors. And actually meant one Greek person from Lukoil. And actually, the idea was that if we will let Lukoil into the factory, it would mean that we would build like some kind of pocket of Russia. And in fact, as the company was sold to Americans, of course, we just not have it. The Druzhba pipeline was under construction in the course of like 4 months, and it was closed, and it was not economically efficient in order to transport oil through other means, and it means that this Williams company, in this case, has to sell the company again to Russian company Europe. which was like, okay, let's do this better version, not when you're going to go. But afterwards, with some kind of like legal maneuvers, when leaders of Yugos were like, when Yugos was nationalized, actually, the Lithuanian government was able, by Russian, the Lithuanian government was able to buy it out and to sell again. In this case, again, the Polish company Orlen, which is actually a state controlled company. And what we have again, like problem with supply of crude oil to the back. And in fact, it's a very good illustration how big powers, or any powers, actually react. If you dismiss, if you let them in, of course, then they have other means to implement their policies. And if you could imagine that, you know, Russian company would be okay for this refined factory now, I'm sure there would be no such problems. I'm not 100% enthusiastic about this. It doesn't solve all problems, because in case of World War II, for example, if you have a bullying neighbor, which is completely crazy, you know, it doesn't care about private investments, and then any kind of investment, of course, it doesn't. But in most cases, I guess it's very off. And the case of Switzerland also is kind of, in this case.
In general, and let's be practical, what do you think about your country's foreign policy? What do you like about it, or would you change anything dramatically?
You know, but the Lithuanians are a little bit like longing for great past and happiness with Lithuania, but when actually with Moscow once under control of Lithuania, looks.
It's the most of
Together with both, that's all. But, and then this actually, this is a kind of national, not pride, but more strong inside, even to resist the Soviet occupation after World War II. So that's, I think that was one of the reasons why the resistance was even more active in New Zealand than like the Soviets, my hypothesis. But now it plays a very negative role because New Zealand tries to negotiate and act in every kind of orange or color revolutions, like in Ukraine, or try to be negotiated in case of Georgia, whatever. I mean, this is completely wrong because I think it's very impractical, Swedish approach, and get involved into quarrels. I think that's wrong. But what I think is very good is just to tell the truth, to base foreign policy on truth. And for example, now Lithuania, they are mentioning the EU, which is vetoing EU negotiations with Russia on several grounds, including Russia's military actions in Caucasus, including denying to Central Lithuania those people who were involved in killings of some people during the 90s, and including some other aspects. And as you know, all these states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Poland mostly, where those states who made some severe comments concerning the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, or big national war, as the Russian called. And when they said that, you know, for some countries, the World War II didn't finish with May 9th. And then, you know, that we were still occupied. So telling these truths, I think, is very crucial. And I think that many people have to understand that, you know, if you go to major cities in Russia, the main streets of the cities are still named Communist Street, Lenin Street, and Silver Street. And, you know, communist killers are, they have monuments there. That Stalin is one of us, as you recall, one of the most popular figures in Russia. And, you know, this is one of my thing, being a neighbor of such a country.
Paul.
I have one question to Justin and then Robert regarding the North Pole moving future. What do you see, what's going to happen next? I mean, very unlikely that Trump will get a nomination of the Republican Party. And he has spoke out about the information environment. He might speak there or not, or how do you see this going forward in many year perspective, not like until presidential elections?
Well, you know, the Ron Paul people are very well organized. They are very dedicated, and they're very active in the local party organizations. in Kansas, in Texas, in Oklahoma, in Montana, and in a few other states, and they are causing plenty of trouble for the GOP establishment. So what they have is what the Trotskyists used to call the entryist strategy. That is, you enter a large organization that has some views that are compatible with your own. And you enter and you organize inside, and you try to recruit in that way. And that's what they're doing. I mean, even in San Francisco, I had the Ron Paul people are running a full slate of candidates for County Central Committee. So, I mean, this is a long, patient roaring from within. It's just like in Great Britain, on the left, you have the militant tendency of Trotsky group, which actually took over the Labour Party in, I believe, the 1980s, or the late 1980s. And I think, well, watch on TV for the platform fight over foreign policy right on the floor of the Republican National Convention. We have delegates. I think we have like 55 delegates to the National Convention, and they can get up and they can speak and they can make motions, and they will. So it's going to be very, but it's a long-term thing. I mean, you have to build a national network of local organizations that do the very patient, boring from within, and educational work that needs to be done. And Ron Paul's biggest triumph may be that he had a book that was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So, his book is being read by millions of people, and it's being pushed, and ideas rule the world. So if they do, and we have the best ones, maybe we're doing after all. Who knows?
In addition to that, it's a long-term project, and the chances of it succeeding are fairly good. The majority of people who are involved and dedicated are pretty young, teenagers, 30s, is a huge majority in Europe as well. We cannot say yet what's going to happen in a year or so, which is short term still, but we can say that it's going to say these people are mentally out of the system. They're not going to go back in. They're staying out, and they're doing that educational thing because they like to do it. It's like Wikipedia. It's the thing. You write about what you like, and people learn from that.
Hey, Ron.
You're going
to get 5 o'clock.